In the beginning of creation, four-headed Brahma received the science of devotional service from the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna. Brahma taught this divine science to Devasi Narada, and Narada imparted it to Krishna, Dvaipayana Vyas. Sripad Madhavacharya, who is also known as Purna Prajna Tirtha, calls himself a servant of Vyas, and he is the guru and sole refuge of Padmanabha Tirtha. The two other principal disciples of Madhva are Nrihari Tirtha and Madhava Tirtha. Madhava Tirtha accepted the great Paramahansa Akshobhya Tirtha as a disciple. The principal disciple of Akshobhya Tirtha was known as Jaya Tirtha, serving whom was Jaya Sindhu's only purpose in life. Jnana Sindhu taught the science of devotional service to Dayanidhi. His servant was Vidyanidhi. Vidyanidhi in turn imparted this knowledge to Rajendra Tirtha, and he accepted Jaya Dharma as his servant. In this way, you should properly understand this disciplic succession. The great sannyasi, Sri Purushottam Tirtha, received the knowledge of devotional service from Jaya Dharma. The principal disciple of Purushottam Tirtha was the saintly Subramanya Tirtha, whose servant was the great Vyasa Tirtha. Vyasa Tirtha's servant was Lakshmipati Tirtha, and his disciple was Madhavendra Puri Goswami. The chief disciple of Madhavendra Puri was Ishwara Puri, and two of his other disciples were the renowned incarnations of Godhead, Sri Nityananda and Advaita Acharya. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the spiritual preceptor of all the worlds, made Ishwara Puri greatly fortunate by accepting him as a spiritual master. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is non-different from Sri Sri Radha and Krishna, and is the very life of those Vaishnavas who follow in the footsteps of Srila Rupa Goswami. Sri Sarupa Damodara Goswami, Rupa Goswami, and Sanatana Goswami gave great happiness to Vishwambar Lord Chaitanya. The great souls Jiva Goswami and Raghunath Das Goswami became very dear to Rupa Goswami. Raghunath Das Goswami's beloved student was Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, who was an intimate friend of Lokanath Goswami. Lokanath Goswami's single disciple was Narottam Das. He always engaged in the service of his guru and was also very dear to Krishna Das Kaviraj. To serve the lotus feet of Narottam Das Thakur was the only desire of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur was the instructor and spiritual master of Baladeva Vidyabhushana. Jagannath Das Babaji was a very prominent acharya after Sri Baladeva Vidyabhushana and was the beloved instructing spiritual master of Sri Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Bhaktivinoda Thakur's intimate friend and associate was the eminent Mahabhagavat Sri Gaurakishore Das Babaji, whose sole joy was found in Hari Bhajan. All these great saintly Vaishnava Paramahansas are members of Lord Gauranga's spiritual family. Their lotus feet are my refuge. I am devoid of any real interest in devotional service, and I am but a poor and lowly Tridanti sannyasi named Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So there's another verse, I didn't see it there. So the renowned Sri Varshnabhanavi Doyati Das, the initiated name of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, is always engaged in the service of the spiritual master, Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji. His foremost disciple preacher is Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who has spread the message of Lord Chaitanya throughout the world and is thus a reservoir of compassion for all fallen souls. Sri Chaitanya Manombistam Shaptam Yenam Bhutalai Swayam Rupa Kitab Mayam Dittati Svam Vedantikam. So, we are reading about the Parampara system, and it's a very important topic. Of course, the idea of spiritual master is stated very clearly in the Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna says, Tadviri paripattena paripashena sevaya upatak jyanti te jnana jnanina tattva darshana. So if one wants tattva darshana, then one has to go to someone who has Tattva Darshana. Tattva Darshana means one who has that darshan, just like when you have darshan of the deities. What happens when you have darshan of the deities? That means you see the deities, isn't it? You can't have darshan if the deities' curtains are closed. It needs to see. So darshan means to see. So Tattva Darshan means for one who has seen the truth. So for one who has seen the truth, he can give the truth. If one has not seen the truth, then that is not the position of spiritual master. So this line of the cyclic succession is a very powerful line. The most powerful, because it is line of Mahabhagavats. Particularly, you'll see every single Vaishnava mentioned here. They are great, powerful acharyas. Very, very powerful. They're not ordinary human beings. They are empowered and very, very close, intimate associates of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So therefore, this line is the powerful line of Lord Gauranga. Lord Chaitanya is the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, so he would not come into any line that wasn't the most powerful. Very powerful. Because it is made up of very, very intimate and confidential associates of Krishna. Therefore, this is the family of Lord Gauranga. This is Lord Gauranga's family, and it is the Bhagavat line. This topic, of course, now is under discussion, but there are actually, the Bhagavat line means that they're Bhagavat devotees. They're direct associates of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. So anyway, that's a deep discussion. Won't go into it tonight. Neither am I qualified to discuss it in such detailed way. But what we should understand is that there is never hopelessness in Krishna consciousness. One should never become hopeless because, you see, you have to understand what is principle of guru. Guru is not some individual. Many people see guru as a singular, in a singular sense. But actually, guru is plural. If you see the introduction of Chaitanya Charitamrita, you will find that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami addresses guru in a plural sense. Why plural? Because it is not such a limited thing. It's not a measurable thing. We try to measure everything. That's our nature. We want to measure. In the material world means measurement. You see, we come here and we are very limited. So if you're limited, you can only get a limited amount of a thing, isn't it? No matter what you try to get in your hand, how much can you hold? Isn't it? Try and hold more than you can hold and it falls off your hand. In your eyes, how much can you grasp? You can never see more than actually one part of what you're seeing, just like I'm sitting in this room. 50% of it is cut off. So how can I talk about what's behind me? And even I can't talk about what's behind me, and I'm sitting in the exact place. So therefore, when there's limited, then there's adjustment. Because you have to make adjustment. I have to move my head. Oh, I saw some. I didn't see him. Now I see him. You see? So I have to make adjustment. So in that sense, because we're in the limited world and everything is limited, we sometimes think that guru is also limited. You see, this is our nature, that there may be some limited aspect to guru. There is no limited aspect. Just like I was in a room with Srila Prabhupada and we were discussing this topic. So one newspaper reporter had come with some other newspaper reporters, and they were big, big newspapers. There was the Times, the Daily Mirror, there was the Telegraph, there was a few. There was about 20 reporters in the room in Bury Place. So Prabhupada, it was very ecstatic to watch Prabhupada when he dealt with people. Prabhupada had an amazing psychology. It was, you can't even describe it. Because he never, ever was victimized. by anyone. In the material world, everyone is victimized. Actually, we're all victims. Because a victim means someone who may be overcome by more powerful thing, isn't it? That's what a victim is in a sort of general term. So I always used to think reporters, of course, they had to behave in a certain way and everything else. But probably it was hilarious because he was so direct, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing. And yet, the people who he was direct with were actually always very respectful because they knew that he was speaking the truth. He never tried to make any kind of, adjustment to the situation to be more acceptable or non-acceptable. Just like in Amsterdam when Prabhupada was doing the installation of Jagannath deities. Then there was all these cameras there. There was about 2 television stations. And there was all sorts of reporters. But anyway, the devotees had made a complete mess up of the installation, including the fact that they had no items for the fire sacrifice. Now, Prabhupada actually was disturbed. He was visibly disturbed at this negligence. So he was chastising the devotees, but then finally they came to the fire sacrifice, and then he said, "Where is the fruit?" So there was no fruit. And one devotee ran off and came back with a fruit salad. So then Prabhupada just blasted the devotee. "You rascal, you nonsense." And of course, we can understand that is business of guru. But the television people obviously were fascinated by this whole arena. But at the same time, Srila Prabhupada, at that time, after all of this, the installation went ahead, everything went ahead, and then Prabhupada was coming out into his car, and they brought some of the feast. Turned out there was a feast anyway. Devotees always made sure there was a feast. Not always sure about anything else. So as they were getting in the car, Prabhupada's servant, who was also a little nervous at the whole occasion, but he dropped the plate of prasadam on the back floor of the car. Nanda Kumar had a particular relationship with Prabhupada. But anyway, so what happened was when Prabhupada got back to his apartment, because there wasn't enough room in the temple, then Prabhupada said, Ananda Kumar was hoping Prabhupada would mention the prasadam. And he was hoping that he may not have even seen him bring it out. So as they got out of the car, then Prabhupada looked over and said, "Bring my prasadam." So Ananda Kumar, remembering the instances of the day, which were pretty intense, he looked in the back of the car, and there was this prasadam, still upside down, on the back of what was a dirty carpet, dirty floor. So he meticulously picked up everything, including the odd pebble and dirt and hair and everything else. And he brought it up to Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada ate every bit of it. Every single crumb. Actually, Nanda Kumar was surprised, because normally Prabhupada didn't eat everything. He always left some. In this particular occasion, he ate everything. And Rabbananandan, who was he was there at the fire sacrifice, was feeling terribly bad because he was the sannyasi, and he felt responsible for the whole sort of fiasco. So he came over to the apartment right after Prabhupada had the feast. And he wanted to go to Prabhupada and fall at his feet, thinking that Prabhupada would be as angry as a lion. So he wanted to get some, forgiveness for his offense. So anyway, he went to the apartment, and when he went in, Prabhupada was actually at both of his knees up against his chest. He was lying on his bed, and he was rocking from side to side, going, "Gauranitai, Gauranitai." And he was actually... Vibhananda described that Prabhupada was beaming from ear to ear. He was smiling like anything. So Vibhananda was completely taken aback. He could not understand at all. So he said to Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, I've come to apologize for all the offenses we've committed against your lotus feet, for the installation and everything. And Prabhupada said, do not worry. Prabhupada, do not take any. Don't worry. He said, Prabhupada, I'm bewildered because, you know, only half an hour ago you were shouting and chastising everyone like a lion, and now you're like a young boy. And Prabhupada just smiled, and he said, it is like the ocean. He said, on the surface of the ocean, there's big, big waves. But if you go deep down into the ocean, there is no turmoil. There is complete tranquility. So, in this sense, that you can understand that Srila Prabhupada was not of the material world, is not of the material world, and these great acharyas, they are not a part of something material. This line of Lord Chaitanya is not a material, it is a spiritual family. It says here, Lord Gauranga's spiritual family. So, we should always remember that to approach Krishna, there is no material impediment. There's nothing in the material world that can stop you from going to Krishna. The only thing that I can actually stop us from going to Krishna is ourselves. So this idea of guru should be understood. It's described very nicely by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur also, and Prabhupada and many great acharyas. That actually everything is guru. Everything is guru, because guru means support. You see, guru is that thing which gives you support. Just like I was in Prabhupada's room one time, and we asked Srila Prabhupada, we said that, can you describe something about guru? And Prabhupada was reading at the time, he had his glasses, so he took off his glasses. He said, guru is like this. And he showed us the glasses, and we thought, we're trying to figure it out. So Prabhupada said is that the glasses, they allow me to see perfectly. So they are the medium, if you like. But Prabhupada's words, I can't remember exact detail. But Prabhupada basically was giving the explanation that the glasses are a support. You need support, because actually, how can you read if you have bad eyesight? You can't see any of the words. Even the book is very near to you, but you can't see. So the medium is the glass. You take shelter of the glass. By taking shelter of the glass, the object is attained. But you shouldn't understand that reading a book means looking at glasses. You understand the point? It's not that when you say, I'm going to read, then you get your glasses and all the time looking at the glass. No, the idea is that you must understand the difference between support. Support means that thing which gives us shelter. And everyone requires shelter. Now, how can Krishna refuse shelter to his devotees? There's no question. And it should be understood that material energy is created to actually bring the devotee. Oh, yeah. To bring the devotee to the point of complete shelter. So there are many things which support that. Just like Bhav Mangal Thakur, he was actually having an illicit relationship with a prostitute. But in his, glorification of guru, he glorifies Chintamani. Now, Chintamani was a prostitute who obviously was engaged in a sexual relationship with Bhav Mangal Thakur. So why does he remember her as guru? Because actually it was by her direction that he went to Vrindavan and became one of the most intimate and confidential devotees, one of the most intimate and confidential servants of Krishna. Therefore he remembers Chintamani. So in one sense, that this is also described by Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, the plural indication of the spiritual master. So that is not also to teach impersonalism. Everything in Krishna consciousness is very personal. So we're not saying that guru is some impersonal kind of thing, no. Actually, guru is Chaita Guru. Chaita Guru means that Krishna is in the heart. And he says that in Bhagavad Gita. Who knows that verse? This is the Bhagavad Gita. Say it loud. And the translator?
I'm sitting in everyone's heart, and from here comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. I'm the goal and object of all the Vedic knowledge. I'm the knower of the Vedas and co-founder of the Vedas.
And that sums up everything in a nutshell, because what it's saying, Krishna is saying that I am the spiritual master. You understand? It's the Chaita Guru. What is the meaning of Guru? Guru means spiritual master, guide, one who gives complete shelter. So Guru is there in the heart. Many times when we went to Srila Prabhupada would say, why do you not listen to your heart? Krishna is there in the heart. He is also giving direction. But because our heart is contaminated, therefore, obviously, we cannot always rely upon that perception because of the contamination of the material world. But still, spiritual master is there in the heart. Krishna is there, and he says, I am directing the wonders of all living beings. So that direction of the wanderings of all living beings has to be understood, that the material energy is also part of Krishna's arrangement to bring the living entities back to home, back to Godhead. The material energy is created to bring the living entities back to home, back to Godhead. So this word Maya, although Maya in one sense is that which separates the living entity from Krishna, but in the same sense, Maya also means affection, that it is a manifestation of Krishna's affection. So for the demon, Maya, or the material energy, acts in a very harsh and very, cruel and merciless and in a very, very powerful way, because Krishna says, Mama Maya Dratiya, very powerful. But the same Maya acts in a very wonderful way for the devotees. Because even we see in many examples, you can read the Bhagavatam, many of the Bhagavatam stories are like a nightmare. Devotees going through nightmares, isn't it? It's not all, nice devotees having big maha plates and simply having kirtan and lying around in ecstasy. There's so many difficulties in devotees' lives. There are so many adversities, so many problems, so many things are there. But at the same time, the devotee always knows that this is actually Krishna's special mercy. He knows that. Because the Maya, as Krishna says, Maya Dakshina Prakriti is my energy. It is working under my direction. And this energy is directly the mercy of Krishna. So when something happens to you, that is Krishna's mercy. It may not be what you want. And many times the devotee gets bewildered. But in every sense, you should understand that whatever is coming to us, although it is caused by our karma, the mercy of Krishna is that he uses that same thing to actually bring us back to him. That same karma, which is karma in many ways, is a kind of impersonal thing in the sense that for every action you do, you get a reaction. Just like Prabhupada says, if you go into a courtroom and the judge is hanging someone, that doesn't mean the judge is a killer or a murderer. He's simply rewarding you for your activities. So karma is very much that. It's a reward for activities we've done. We get a certain reaction. At the same time, Prabhupada always explained that for a devotee, when he gets a reaction or when he suffers in a certain way, then he realizes. Just like Prabhupada said, if you get a knock on your leg, you should have understood that in your real karmic situation, you could have even lost the leg. That kind of thing. In that example, that there's a great minimization of karma. If there was a minimization of karma by Krishna, we couldn't make any real progress in spiritual life. It'd be very, very difficult. But at the same time, this situation of the material world is also support, because in the spiritual world, Radharani supports Krishna's pastimes. Therefore, Yogamaya. Yogamaya means that she is the supporting energy of Krishna, just like Krishna is the enjoying energy. Krishna means Purusham. Adi Govindam Adi Purusham. Tamaham Bhajami. His business is to enjoy. If you want to enjoy, you need certain things, isn't it? Anyone who wants to enjoy, you need something. But of course, there's no need in the spiritual world. But in the material world, there's a need. And therefore, what we call different types of varieties, they are the support to our pleasure, isn't it? They give us support. Just like someone has a wife, they go, oh, you're my pillar of support. Oh, you're my this or that. Everyone knows that in order to have help, assistance, support, we need all these things. We are vitally in need. Therefore, these things are called artha, those things we need. Unfortunately, in the material world, they manifest as anartha, those things we don't need, but which we think we need. So, therefore, just as Radharani is supporting or accommodating, of course, Lord Balaram is accommodating, Radharani is supporting. It's a very complex discussion. But basically, you should understand that Radharani's business is only to give pleasure to Krishna. And what is her other business is always to increase Krishna's pleasure. Try and understand that. That Radharani's other business is she's always trying to increase Krishna's pleasure. Now, increase means more number, isn't it? Normally, when you talk in a mathematical sense, if you say, I've increased my savings, I've added some numbers. So therefore, Srimati Radharani is always anxious that all of those living entities that have chosen to forget Krishna, that they will actually come back to Krishna. That is a great anxiety. Anxiety means, out of love for Krishna, she wants that all living entities should come back to home, back to Godhead. So therefore, if we understand Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he is the manifestation of the internal potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, his business is, what is his business? What was Lord Chaitanya's business? Is that when Lord Chaitanya comes, then there are all of the restrictions, all of the conditions. They are actually, nullified by his appearance. Because normally, you see, you have to understand, in one sense, we have to understand how this energies work. But when the energetic comes, the energetic means, Krishna, of course, is the energetic. And Krishna means what? Radha Krishna. So Radharani is also the energetic source of devotional service, bhakti. So her business is always to increase the number of Krishna's devotees. So Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has manifested that pastime. So therefore, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Kali Yuga, he has completely opened the gates of love of God, and all of these followers of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they are all intimate associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and therefore they are able to bestow upon all the fallen conditioned souls the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. There is no material consideration. Of course, we should understand that one has to follow completely the principle of parampara. There's no question of that. But you should also understand that there is higher principle than what we consider by our own interpretation. Because the highest principle of Krishna consciousness is, which Krishna says in the 18th chapter, sarva dhamma pratyaja mamekam saranam vraja hang tang sarva papebhyo mukshishami masacha. So what does Krishna say? Give up all varieties of dharma. Now what is dharma? Dharma means religiosity. Now that should be studied in a sense, because Krishna is saying something very revolutionary. Give up all varieties of religiosity and just surrender unto me. You see, that point is very, very important, that this surrender unto Krishna. Now, one may say, I can't surrender because I have so many problems. Isn't it? One may say like that. It's natural. We can say, I can't surrender Krishna. There are so many reasons why I can't surrender. But then what does Krishna say? What does Krishna say next? Give up all variety of religions. Just surrender unto me. And in return, and then, in return, what does Krishna say? And in return, I will give you all protection. I will free you from everything. So that principle of surrender unto Krishna, that is the single most important factor of all philosophical conclusion. And of course, again, in more and more detail, we can see this from the writings of the Goswamis, the writings of all the great acharyas, that one must completely surrender unto Krishna. Do not fear. This is very, very important, that one should not fear. Because Krishna himself is guaranteeing you that he will take you back to home, back to Godhead. So the support for that surrender is called Guru. You understand? The support for that is actually Guru. So it is not singular, because Krishna is not singular. He's not limited. If you read the lecture Prabhupada gave in 1936, I think it was, to the Gaudiya Math, you will get a very great insight to this principle of Guru. He probably says, there's no difference between my Guru and your Guru. Because Guru is not a limited. So anyway, I do go on and on. But basically, back to this room where Prabhupada was speaking to the newspaper reporters. So, Prabhupada asked one of these reporters, who was one of these very modern ladies, who had a very short dress on, sitting on her chair. She couldn't even sit on the floor. And Prabhupada, he opened up the question. So this lady said, Swami, I'd like to ask you a question. Prabhupada said, yes. She said, I'm writing an article for the Mirror about bogus gurus. And Prabhupada said, bogus guru? What is bogus guru? So she said, well, what I mean is those gurus are bogus. And Prabhupada said, how you mean bogus? So she said, well, those, you know, the gurus, they have a big car. Prabhupada said, I have a big car. And she said, yeah, but they have lots of money. Prabhupada said, I have so much money. So everything she said, Prabhupada said, I have. She said, but I know you're not bogus. The Prabhupada said, how you know? So then Prabhupada says, there is no such thing as bogus guru. He chastised her. How can you write? You are not qualified to write. So he chastised this woman. And she took it quite well, Prabhupada actually. I was surprised. Prabhupada said there is no such thing as bogus guru. Because guru is not a material thing. Material thing means bogus thing. Anything material is bogus. Guru means representative, pure, unadulterated, uncontaminated, representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada basically said there can no possibility of having anything such as a bogus guru. Because guru is, you should understand the absolute principle. It is that thing which takes you to Krishna, which gives you Krishna. So therefore, even Chintamani was a prostitute, but she took Vilmangal Thakur to Krishna. How could she be bogus? Think about it. How can you say that she's bogus? You can say her activities are bogus, but the principle of delivering Vilmangal Thakur is an absolute principle. So therefore you should understand that Krishna is working through prostitutes. How powerful. See how powerful the spiritual energy is, that there is no material consideration to its power. So therefore, of course, what I'm trying to emphasize is that the great Vaishnava acharyas, they have come down to this material world, and the Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself has come, and Prabhupada has come. They have come to deliver everyone, not just the chosen few. There is no question that Lord Chaitanya wanted a limited amount to be delivered. He wanted everyone to go back to home, back to Godhead. And this possibility is there. Just like one time in Prabhupada's room, so Jamuna, she was kind of asking Prabhupada in a very nice way. She said to Srila Prabhupada that, Prabhupada, is it true that if we just chant 16 rounds a day and follow the four regular principles, that we'll go back to home, back to Godhead in this lifetime? And Prabhupada became quiet. He obviously, you could see that Prabhupada was actually hurt. And he said to her, it was like Prabhupada was looking at her to say, how could you doubt me? So Prabhupada says, do you think I would cheat you? Prabhupada said, I guarantee you that if you chant 16 rounds a day and follow the four regulated principles, you will go back to home, back to Godhead in this lifetime. Guaranteed. Now you may say, how is that possible? Yes, that may be so, because one can say I'm very unqualified, and that's true. But then again, there's no qualification for going back to home, back to Godhead. You see? Why? Because there's no material qualification. And all you've got is material qualifications. Isn't it? So in that sense, there's no qualification. If you study properly, you will find that there's actually no qualification for going back to Godhead. So how can you say you're qualified to go back to home, back to Godhead? Because there's no qualification, because it's not a material thing. One does not qualify oneself. One qualifies oneself for getting the mercy of Krishna. Therefore, Prabhupada said, do something, Krishna will recognize. Don't try to see Krishna. Don't try to push your way back to Godhead, or force an entry, or sneak in the back. Not possible. But do something that Krishna will recognize that here is my devotee. Now, there are many examples of in the Vedas and Puranas and Bhagavatam, of many devotees who went back to Godhead in very, very many different ways. One particular story I like was that there was a thief. And this is a true story. He was actually at a Bhagavatam recital. So in the recital, this particular reciter, he was always glorifying Krishna, but always telling about how many beautiful jewels Krishna had. And how he looked very elegant and very nice. And these jewels were priceless. So this thief wasn't very intelligent. But he was very attracted to jewels. So he was very interested in this particular thing. So in the course of the discussion, I think basically he asked the reciter, he said, where is this Krishna staying? Because he thought that he's talking about someone, so he thought, I better go and see this guy. He sounds pretty wealthy. So he said, where is he staying? So he said, oh, he stays in Vrindavan, in the forest. So that thief became very attracted. He said, oh, really? Vrindavan in the forest. So this thief went to Vrindavan. And actually, he was so convinced that Krishna was there that he didn't at all, for one moment, ever think that Krishna wasn't there. So he spent a lot of time looking for Krishna. And Krishna appeared to him. He came from within the forest. He met Lord Krishna. So Krishna, he appeared as a young coward boy. So the thief thought, wow, this is amazing. Here's a boy. That's even better because, you know, when you want to rob a boy, there's not much resistance. So he said to Krishna, he said, oh, you have very nice jewels. And Krishna said, yes, my mother gave me them. So he said, well, can I take these jewels from you? He said, oh, no, my mother will be annoyed if you take. So because of the sweetness of the exchange between the thief and the boy, Krishna, he actually forgot that he had come to rob Krishna. And he actually became a great devotee of Krishna. So the point is that Prabhupada makes this point that Krishna can reciprocate with anyone. You understand? It's not a question that Krishna is looking for some sort of material thing. No. Krishna is looking for that intense desire. You see, that intense desire is the currency or the price by which we can get Krishna. We must be have an intensity, this greed, if you like, lola, this greed. One must have a great intensity to want Krishna. But the thing you should understand is that Krishna is always in a playful mood. So therefore, he doesn't like his devotees to approach him in a awe and reverence. You see? He cannot really approach Vrindavan in awe and reverence because Krishna is a boy and his friends are all young boys, children, and Balaram also. So he wants to play, just like that thief. He somehow Krishna revealed himself to the thief. Because why? Because Krishna wanted to. So this is the point, is that in order to approach Krishna, one has to make friends with one of Krishna's intimate associates. That is how one actually approaches the Supreme Personality of God. Because there's no qualification. There's no actual, what you can say it, anything that you've done that can qualify you for going back to home, back to Godhead. But what does Krishna do? He sends down these intimate devotees as guru. They are called Bhagavat Guru, Mahabhagavat Gurus. They're not ordinary personalities of the material world. They are practically, in so many ways, Nitya Siddhi, but they are eternally liberated souls. They're not to be looked at material. They're not a material thing. They don't exist within our conception of time and space. They may appear at certain times and certain places, but they're always there. They are always there in Lord Gauranga's family. They are always there. And they are the containers, if you like. They contain the ocean of mercy. They are carrying Krishna. And I had practical experience of this with Srila Prabhupada. He was sitting on the Vyasasan. I always remember this very profoundly because it was a very profound moment. And Prabhupada was looking at Radha Landaneshwara in great ecstasy. When you saw Prabhupada relating to the deities, it was not conceivable. It was very hard to describe. It was very, very intimate. So Prabhupada was looking there with great love, and then he was looking at the devotees, and he was looking at the deities, and then he was looking at the devotees. And then Prabhupada said, I have captured Krishna, and I am keeping you here. And he put his hand to his heart. I am keeping him here for you. Now you come and take. And I could understand, anyway, immediately at that point, that something profoundly spiritual was going on at that particular moment, because Prabhupada was revealing his actual position. And that is that Srila Prabhupada has captured Krishna. What does it mean to capture Krishna? How can you capture the Supreme Personality of Godhead? You see, this is very difficult for people to understand. Because in order for you to give something, you must have it, isn't it? So unless you capture Krishna, how can you give him to anyone? You understand? So therefore, Srila Prabhupada was revealing that he had actually captured Krishna, conquered Krishna by his love. And he said, I'm holding him here. I'm holding him. You see? Now, how can you hold God? How can you hold on to God? But Prabhupada was showing it. I'm holding it. Now Prabhupada said, now you come and take. So therefore, we should understand very carefully that this Krishna conscious movement is going on directly on the Srila Prabhupada and directly by Prabhupada's mercy. This movement is the manifestation of Prabhupada's mercy. It is the manifestation of the kindness of Srila Prabhupada because he wanted to deliver everyone. We saw that in his personal life. And we also saw that this was not something related to time and circumstance, because Prabhupada spoke always of the future. He always spoke of his plans that this Sankirtan movement, this ISKCON movement, would go all over the world, that the whole world would be inundated. Prabhupada came to fulfill the direct prophecy of Lord Chaitanya, that my name will be known in every town and village of the world, and Prabhupada came to fulfill that. So it's also interesting because when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was leaving the planet, not leaving the planet, but sending his ambassadors, if you like, or his preachers to the Western world, we must note that actually these particular preachers came at a later part in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's life, and neither were they very successful. Prabhupada said actually that they weren't able to fulfill the desire of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. But Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that now that wonderful time has come, that joyful time has come, when the message of Rupa Sanatana, Lord Chaitanya, will go to the Western world, and this attempt to spread this message in the Western world is the humble offering of this servant of Krishna. You see, so the humble offering. In other words, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had a desire to deliver the whole world, and that was his offering to Lord Chaitanya. Srila Prabhupada was practically the only disciple of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur to understand the heart of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. You see? So that means Prabhupada was the most confidential, the most intimate disciple of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And therefore, he was able to fulfill that mission. Therefore, Prabhupada used to say to us, "My Guru Maharaj has sent you." He told us that one time. He said, "He sent all of you. My Guru Maharaj is very kind. He has sent all of you all over the world so that you will assist me in this humble service to my Guru Maharaj." So Srila Prabhupada was aware that all of the arrangements that were going on was his Guru Maharaj. Just like I was sitting in Bombay in Prabhupada's room. So just to show you also many of the qualities of Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada was extremely humble and extremely respectful, even to his own disciples, even though he also could be like a lion. But there's also another side of Prabhupada which is very, very intimate. So I was sitting with Prabhupada, so Prabhupada said, "Tribhuvanath Prabhu." And I was shocked, you know, to be called Prabhu by Prabhupada. How can you be called Prabhu by your spiritual master? But still, Prabhupada said, "Could you put on the light?" So I put on the light for Prabhupada. And then we sat there. So I wanted to glorify Prabhupada, and here was a nice chance. So I started glorifying him. I said, "Srila Prabhupada, what you have done, no other acharya has done, no other messenger of Krishna has been able to do. You have come from aristocratic family, you have come from very high, I think I use the word in the sense that you have come from such a great lineage, and you have come to such a horrible place, Western country, full of malechas and low-class people. And in such a short time, you have been able to spread this Krishna consciousness all over the world." And then I said, also pointing to Prabhupada's books, I said, "You have done all these books as well in such a short time. It's completely bewildering how you have done this, Srila Prabhupada." And it's difficult to explain because Prabhupada was listening, but it's like Prabhupada was also so deep that Prabhupada could always tell your heart. There's many occasions where devotees used to try and speak to Prabhupada, but you spoke to Prabhupada with your heart. Prabhupada knew your heart. So he knew I genuinely was speaking from the heart. And then Prabhupada, he became like, it was almost like a child. He became very, very soft and extremely, deeply humble. Prabhupada said, "Actually, I have done nothing." He said, "Whatever you are seeing," he said, "it is my Guru Maharaj. He has done everything." So Prabhupada never thought for one minute that anything he did was actually him. He always understood that it was his Guru Maharaj. But he actually realized that. There's a difference between thinking that and realizing that. So in the higher level, one can understand that Srila Prabhupada was the manifestation of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's humble offering at the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And we inherit the legacy of also becoming part of Srila Prabhupada's humble offering at the lotus feet of his Guru Maharaj. So therefore there's a great responsibility, and that is the meaning of parampara. That Prabhupada said one time, guru means heavy. The guru, the spiritual master, means heavy. And when you take shelter of a spiritual master, you take on the weight of the guru. You see, what is the weight of that guru? What is the weight of the guru is that the guru, the spiritual master, is representing the mercy of Radharani. So therefore, that is very heavy. Radharani's mercy is very heavy. Lord Chaitanya's mercy is very heavy. And therefore, when we take shelter of such personalities, then we also have to carry that great weight. But at the same time, of course, because we are being supported by the internal energy, therefore everything is possible. there is all possibility, there is all victory to the Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya. So we saw in Srila Prabhupada's personal life that even though Prabhupada, just like you're seeing Prabhupada sitting behind his desk, that's basically how I always saw Prabhupada. Prabhupada was always completely relaxed, transcendental, and always talking about Krishna, always chanting. Sometimes Prabhupada would sit in his room hours on end chanting bhajans. And in the evening, he would give darshan. In the morning, he would give instructions to all the managers and different things. So practically speaking, all that Prabhupada did really was just glorify Krishna. We saw that practically. He was always glorifying Krishna. Even when Prabhupada was talking, you could see him chanting. He used to chant while he talked. Always. I used to watch him because I could see it. But Prabhupada would be chanting japa while talking. Now, you can't understand that, but there are examples in our line also. Prabhupada, I noticed anyway, maybe others noticed, I don't know, but Prabhupada was always chanting. Always chanting. When Prabhupada got sick and they took him to hospital, he had to have some minor operation or whatever, because of heart or some problem. So the doctor, they were complaining to the devotees, this man is always praying. He never stops. We can't stop him praying. You ask him to stop. He never, practically speaking, he's always, always chanting. And Garga Muni, what happened was that, this is a true story, Garga Muni told me directly, not long after it happened actually, but Prabhupada had to be, put it on anesthetic. So they gave Prabhupada an injection and it didn't work. So the doctor couldn't figure it out because normally, I don't know if you've ever had an injection for anesthesia, but you're out pretty quick. So they gave another injection and still nothing happened. And the doctor called Garga Muni over and he said, you know, we've given him enough anesthesia to knock out an elephant. And he said, nothing's happening. We're completely bewildered. What should we do? Give him another injection? We've given him more dosage than we've ever given him. So Garga Muni was bewildered. He said, well, let me ask Prabhupada why, what's happening. So Prabhupada said, there's a problem. So Garga Muni said, yes, Prabhupada, they want you to go unconscious. And Prabhupada said, why they don't tell me? So then Prabhupada went unconscious. So the point is that there are so many incidents in Srila Prabhupada's life that one could understand. Anyway, that Srila Prabhupada was always simply glorifying Krishna. Simple method. That one should simply glorify Krishna. That is all Krishna consciousness is about. It's simply about glorifying Krishna. Such a simple thing. We try to live, just like one time Prabhupada said, this Krishna consciousness is so simple, you will miss it. He used to say that on occasion. So simple. Everyone thinks, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Everything except glorify Krishna. But actually, all Krishna is looking for is our love. And the glorification should be done with love. That's all the Krishna consciousness is glorifying Krishna out of love. Because the nature of the spiritual world, what is the nature of the spiritual world? Is that it is inhabited by beings, by living entities who only want to glorify Krishna. And what is the nature of the material world? It is inhabited by living beings who only want to glorify themselves. Slight difference, isn't it? Huh? So therefore, every endeavor of the material world is to glorify oneself, either in the form of gaining some material thing, showing off that thing, getting some money, getting prestige, getting position, getting adoration, getting glory, getting fame, getting power, always getting, gaining something. Gaining something what? So that one can glorify his material position. So Krishna consciousness simply means glorifying Krishna. And by glorifying Krishna, then one frees himself from all false consciousness, all false identification with his body. So that therefore, one gradually, it is not that so quickly, because we're very, very attached to our materialistic, egotistic position. But gradually that this glorification of Krishna goes on, one gradually purifies the heart, melts the heart. Krishna melts the heart. Madan, Mohan. What is the meaning of Mo? Anybody know? Mo. We say Mo. Attachment. Exactly. Mohan. One who can attract and attach the hearts of everyone. So in the material world, it is signified by attachment. The reason we're here is attachment, isn't it? That's why we're still here. Just like one time Prabhupada was saying, as the devotee was saying to Prabhupada on a walk, that Prabhupada, what was the exact word that we used? The devotee was explaining that because of Maya, one is in a certain situation. But Prabhupada explained, in the material world, it's just like you are embracing a tree, and then you are saying to the tree, let me go. See? Let me go. But you are holding on very tight to the tree, but you're telling the tree, let me go, you tree. Why are you holding me like this? So material world is technically slightly not impersonal, but the material energy acts according to our attachment. If we're attached, then it acts in a very complex way to increase our attachment. And similarly, if we are attached to Krishna, then the spiritual energy acts in a very wonderful way to increase our attachment. So living entity means marginal, tataishta. Shakti means that just like the beach is sometimes covered with water, sometimes it's dry land. You can't say the beach is land and you can't say it's water. But on the marginal perimeter, on that marginal position, we can become attached to Krishna. So we have to accept everything favorable for that attachment to Krishna. Or we can become attached to the material world, which makes it unfavorable for Krishna consciousness. So that marginal thing is there in our consciousness. We can see it at every moment. At every moment, we have a choice to forget Krishna or to remember Krishna. And usually, we choose the one to forget Krishna, whatever reason. It's a nature we choose. We must, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, accept everything favorable for remembering Krishna. That is the only regulated principle of spiritual life, is that one should accept everything favorable. And the negative side is one must reject everything unfavorable. That is real renunciation. Okay. So anyway, I'll finish up. I know you like to hear stories of Prabhupada. So I'll tell a few. But what I'd like to, I'll finish up quickly though. But I'd like to try and explain that the mood in the early days, because there's slightly, obviously, 25, 28, 30 years later, I think it's about 30 years later, there's a difference in moods with the movement. When we first joined, when I first came in touch with the devotees, the whole emphasis of the movement was to glorify Krishna. And that was because Prabhupada directly instigated that. He set the movement up in such a way. I'll give you an example. We got up in the morning, and all of us went to, you know, Mangalari. Then we chanted japa in the temple room. And everyone who knows in those days, that was the most ecstatic japa period. The devotees used to literally be bouncing off the wall. I don't know why, but it was very ecstatic, and we all remember that. Then we had our morning class. Then after class, we had our breakfast. Then we did about half an hour cleaning, 1 hour cleaning or something, and then we went out, which used to be about 10:30, right through to 5 o'clock on Harinam. Every day. There wasn't a day except Sunday that we stopped. So we used to even bring the prasadam out on the street. And we would take prasadam in the park, and then we'd come back. So usually we used to get it back about 5:30. Now, if you just join the movement, which I had, and Haribu, you know, next thing you're out on the street for 8 hours. It's quite intense, because normally you think, you know, go out for an hour and you think, you know, wow, this is intense. But it was like, and in those days, remember, there was very few devotees. It's not that it was this big, wild kirtans. It was actually sometimes, I mean, one guy bumped into me, and he'd become a devotee. And he said to me, hey, he said, you know, he said, I remember you from Bury Place. And I hadn't remembered it. But he, since he'd gone to another temple, but he'd become a devotee. And this was very recently, actually, not so long ago. I think about 6 months ago or something, I bumped into him. So he said, yeah, he said, you were the first guy I met. And now this is now 28 years later or something. I said, really, yeah. He said, yeah, you're walking around about 10 o'clock at night in Piccadilly doing Harinam on your own. So I said, oh, yeah, I remember. Because sometimes it turned out that there was usually, we had a thing in those days that there was, we were also kind of, because we were on the Apple label, so we used to go and do these programs sometimes. So sometimes the devotees were away doing programs. So I remember we used to go out, sing alone on Saturday night, doing Harinam Piccadilly. I did it many, many times. And another devotee, at least there used to be two or three of us, but at least there'd be one. But sometimes there was also 20 or 30 devotees. It depends on the occasion. So he was actually, he said, you know, he said, I was so impressed, he said. I said, I was walking down, he was telling me the story, he said, I was walking down Piccadilly just about to go to the movies or something. He said, I saw this guy coming along. And he looked like jumping up and down, playing these things. He said he looked completely oblivious to what was going on. And he thought to himself, he said, there must be something in this. So that's how he came to the temple. And funny enough, he didn't stay long, then he went off and he went to another temple. Because he was just visiting England anyway. But the point was is that was our program. We went out and all day long we did kirtan. All day long. And then we came back at night. Now listen to this. And this is true. I'm sitting in front of Guru Maharaj. I can't tell lies. We would take prasadam. We would come back and take prasadam. Then we'd have the evening aarti, which generally went on for quite a while. And then we went out in Harinam again. And we used to stay out. Of course, later on, that got a bit risky because we used to stay out till 10, 10:30, 11. Sometimes we got chased by drunks and everything. And we started getting arrested quite regularly. Actually, you'll see in some of Prabhupada's conversations, he talks about devotees getting arrested every day in London. And that was because I reported to him about it. He asked me, in Bury Place, he said, so how are things? Because I was actually temple president at 18. I was 18 years of age. And this is another amazing thing, how things worked in ISKCON. There was no, at that time, there was no GBC even. There was no management structure or anything. There was just this continuous Harinam. And as a result, everything seemed to go on. Literally, there was no collection. We didn't have books. All we used to do is we'd go out with sticks of incense and a conch shell. And we'd walk up to people and give them a stick of incense. We had a thing, we had a thing where we had to let the people smell the incense because they didn't know what it was. So we used to rub it under the nose. And it used to leave a black mark. And then the devotees used to kind of get an excitement out of that because they go like that and they'd be like, this black mark. And the person would go walking off down the road with a mustache. So we had this, sticks of incense in our conch shell. And I remember our collection was, you know, literally 30p, 40. I remember I did the biggest one, so it was £2. That was a full day on the street. But we had these Harinams, and they were very, very static. Everyone went in Harinam. Everyone who came just went. And honestly, there was a fight to get out. Now, this was going out every day of the week. There was a fight to get out. Now, in those days, we sheared everything. I mean, it was kind of hard to explain. I don't know why, but we sheared everything, including the toothpaste, the toothbrush, everything. Whatever was there. We had this toothpaste. Someone got this brilliant. It was kind of funny in the early days because we always used to get these things Prabhupada said. So someone got this thing that Prabhupada said you should have toothpaste made of mustard oil and salt. Now, I don't know if you know mustard oil. It's very, very hot. So this devotee would get a bottle of mustard oil. Any other toothpaste was Maya, it was demonic, it was everything. But this toothpaste was bona fide. So he'd have this big bowl of salt and a bottle of mustard, which a devotee would add regularly. And people would stick their toothbrush in. So he had all these promises of and they'd be all. And everyone would be going, ah! And you had this kind of, you had this burning in your mouth the whole morning. And we used to share all the clothes as well. And in those days, we had some really spaced out bhaktas. I mean, if you saw them, you couldn't believe them. But there were some real spaced out guys. So they used to just put everything in the machine and it used to tangle in these huge knots. Because I don't know if you've ever put about 50 dhotis in a machine. But when you pull them out, it's just this big, huge knot. And that used to get chucked in the dryer. And when we come back, we used to have a tea chest. You know, those wooden tea chests. I haven't seen them around so much, but they were for carrying tea. We had one of those, and we put all the clothes in there. So everyone would come along and undo this knot, and that was your clothes. And the bedding was kept in one cupboard, and everyone would share the bedding. So if you're late to bed, you didn't get any bedding. And it was these few blankets. We were extremely poor. I mean, you can't imagine, it's hard to imagine, but our food all came from donations. Everything we ate came from donations. We used to go to the market, and it literally, I remember on several occasions, there was no question of having socks. That was like, you know, luxurious if you had some socks. But if you had some shoes, it was pretty good. Because we used to share, everyone used to just grab shoes to go in Harinam. So on several occasions, many occasions, we'd have people on Harinam in bare feet. And people would buy shoes for them. We were really scruffy. We had these dhotis, because we never had dhotis from India at that time. No one had, we didn't even, you know to get dhotis from India. We used to buy locally. And the material, everyone was into this bright saffron, because we were all Brahmacharis, most Brahmachari, Brahmacharini predominantly. So we bought this, you know, bolt, because we used to get these Indian people to give us the cheapest nylon that you could buy. But it was bright orange. But I don't know if you know nylon, when you wash it, it becomes electrified. It's like, so when you used to pull it out of the dryer, it used to get almost electrocuted. And then when we would wear it, after you washed it about 100 times, because you're not supposed to put nylon through a machine every day and dry. the dhoti would become like a, it was almost like a creepy fungus that would, it would climb up your leg. You know, it was so sort of like plastified, a plastic. So we go out in the middle of winter with these nylon dhotis in the pouring rain. The other thing we had was we'd never stop even if it was raining. We had this thing, because Oxford Street doesn't have a lot of protection. Now, if you're going out every day of the week and it's raining, we used to just go out raining. So now and again we take shelter. A lot of times we just carry on, well, Lord Chaitanya's moving, Harry Ball, and we go through. So snow, rain, everything. But the main thing was, and this is something which was really very, very important, was that the whole temple was actually static. It was electrified with the holy name. And even in the sleep, devotees used to chant. I saw many times devotees would be lying there going, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Because they'd be completely immersed in the chanting. So that's how basically the Prabhupada set up the movement. There was no meetings or management or discussions about what we're going to do. We just simply went out on Kirtan Harinam, and then every now and again a devotee would say, oh, I'm off to Italy to open the temple. Someone would go off to Amsterdam. I went off to Scotland, and I remember when I went to Scotland, I you know, it was like a thing where no one had said go to Scotland, but I just heard that Prabhupada was educated by a teacher. Tananjaya got a letter, and Prabhupada was explaining about his teacher was from Edinburgh. So I thought, and Prabhupada said in it, you are also Scottish from Edinburgh, you should preach in Edinburgh. So Tananjaya was off to Italy or something, Amsterdam or something. So I thought, well, let me go to Edinburgh. So I took one devotee, Kishore. And we went up there. And we went around knocking on people's houses. And when they'd open the door, we'd say, can we stay with you? Now, we were clean shaven with this nylon dhotis and curl. I don't know what we looked like. With this bright tilak. Now, people in those days didn't know the Hare Krishna movement. And definitely not in Scotland. So we usually got this look like, not only can you not stay with us, but what the heck are you doing at my door? But we didn't know anything else to do because we went up there with we had a few pounds. I think we had 2 pounds, 3 pounds. Now to start a temple with 2 or 3 pounds is not easy. And we didn't know how we were going to do it anyway. So we came to this one door and we knocked. And this guy opened the door. And he was an old Polish refugee from the war. But he'd been living with his wife there. And his wife had died in a room upstairs. He'd never gone in it since, which was years earlier. So, funny enough, the guy was so lonely, I think he was happy that anyone even knocked on his door. And I think he took pity on us because it was late at night and it was particularly cold when we went up there. It was freezing. And he said, well, I have a room upstairs. He said, you could stay there. And We then pointed out, we were very grateful, we pointed out that we had very little money. So he said, well, it's all right. He said, you can pay me whatever you can afford. I think we worked it out at £3 a week or something, £4 a week. But anyway, we stayed there. Now, this room had a double bed. And it was about the size of, probably about the size of Prabhupada's bathroom. It wasn't a big room. It wasn't a big house. I had this big double bed, and I had a gas ring for a gas fire, which later on, we got a gas ring that we used to cook on. We used to connect it to the fire thing, and that was our kitchen. So we had that for cooking on. We had a double bed in the room, which took up most of the room, and that's where we lived for about 8 months. And every day we went out in Harinam, every single day, and we used to bring guests back to the room. Now, it was way out of the city center, but not only that, when people would come in, they'd have to sit the other side of the double bed. So all of our conversations on philosophy was across the double bed, which is most unusual. And I think people were pretty bewildered when they came in. But anyway, that's how we conducted our temple. And when I was out one day, I was looking around, there's this big building, it was a market. It was a hippie market, but it was huge. And I noticed that the top part of it was very, had all these gargoyles, and it was a real gothic type of building. But it was empty, so I thought, wow, that's empty, that's unbelievable. Right in the heart of the town, such a big place is empty. What I didn't know was that building was used by Aleister Crowley for his black magic and all of his witchcraft. So that's probably why it was empty, but I didn't know at the time. So anyway, I went to the, I found from the city records, town council records, who owned the building. I went to them. They were an insurer. It was a solicitor acting on behalf of someone who I've never met to this day. But they couldn't rent it. That's what I came to the conclusion now, looking back. They couldn't rent it to anyone. So they were very happy that someone would take care of it, because they were worried about a fire, because the market people were keeping all their rubbish on these floors above it. So he gave me the building. And I, at that time, also had no money, because our bank account wasn't existing. I said to him when he agreed to let us rent it, I said, there is one problem. And I said, is we have no money. We're monks. But we've been sent there by a Guru Maharaj. He wanted a temple in Edinburgh, so I've come to do that. So I think the guy just took so much pity. I mean, here's an 18-year-old kid, or 19, trying to start a center for some guru, and it's like he hasn't got a hope in hell. So he gave me the place for, I think it was £12 a week. This huge building, it was three floors. The temple room was this, it was about three, it was nearly the size of the temple room downstairs. It was a big temple, it was about three quarters that size. Anyway, you could get 200 people in there or something like that. It was a big temple room. And it had a lot of rooms. And there was me and this one other brahmachari, and we suddenly had a temple, whereas we were living in a little room with a bed. And we made a couple of devotees, although they were very shaky, but we were hanging on to them. What happened was that I got the building and I wrote to Shyam Sundar. So Shyam Sundar read the letter to Prabhupada while Prabhupada was having a massage in Bombay, and Prabhupada became very ecstatic and very pleased. Shyam Sundar wrote me back, and Prabhupada was very pleased that you have gotten the temple. And Prabhupada actually wrote me a letter also, a very nice letter, 2-page letter, which is very unusual to get a very long letter. Prabhupada talked about his childhood in that letter, and it was a very, very sweet letter. So anyway, I went down when Prabhupada arrived on one of his regular visits coming through London, and we were on a morning walk. So then Prabhupada said to me, oh, so Tribhuvanath, do you have temple? And this is another thing to understand, that Prabhupada was extremely personal. He always called even his disciples, he knew their names, all of them. I mean, not every single one, but whenever I saw Prabhupada, always remembered names. But he always used to call by my name in a very extremely courteous way. Prabhupada was a gentleman. He was gentle, saintly, all good qualities decorated his body and his heart. And Prabhupada was always very extremely humble. I mean, I've seen it over the years, people try to somehow imitate Prabhupada. No one could ever imitate Prabhupada, because Prabhupada was unlimitedly deep, very deep, but always full of love. So Prabhupada said, so Tribhuvanath, in a loving way, he said, so you have temple, Edinburgh? And I said, yes, Prabhupada, we have our temple. Prabhupada said, so I am coming. So I was shocked. I said, Prabhupada, you're coming? Edinburgh? If you look at how many temples Prabhupada visited, actually, there's a lot of big, big temples Prabhupada didn't visit. But Prabhupada wanted to come. Now, that presented a difficulty, because we had this big building with about, I don't know, 20 rooms or something, big rooms, and we had nothing, no money or nothing. So immediately I was ecstatic. I said, oh, Prabhupada, that would be wonderful. I said, but Prabhupada, the only thing is we have no arrangement there. Prabhupada said, do not worry. I will come. So I had to then get everything ready, and Prabhupada was coming within about a week. So we had one really far out devotee, Charanaravindam, who was he was like one of these really, you know, bizarre hippies who liked to paint everything in a hippie fashion. So he went up there and he splattered the place with paint. In the shower room, he painted the Himalayan mountains, took away the shower faucet and put a hole. So when you turn the tap on, the water came out the wall. And it was like a waterfall from the Himalayas. I'm pretty sure it was cold water as well. In Scotland, water gets really cold. And then we painted all, you know, it was like real Indian type of painting. But anyway, so Prabhupada's room was a difficulty because we had nothing to put in there. And it shows you how poor we were, because we went down to one market and begged an old kitchen table, which was a big table, but it was ugly as anything. We painted it a sort of fluorescent green or something. You know, it was just an ugly old green color. I think we got some cheap paint. So we painted it out and we cut the legs off. So it was about that high off the ground, but it was massive. And then we managed to get an old bed, which you fold up. You know, one of those things you get? So we got one of those. So we thought that would be, you know, Prabhupada's bed. And I think the other thing we had was, a one-bar electric fire. Now, that building was freezing, but we had no other means of heating it. So we bought this fire for Prabhupada. And that was it. We painted the room, the floor, the ceiling, and the walls, all the same color. And put a bit of mat down. So we walked in there, it looked like something out of a kind of hippie thing, you know, where it was like just half-baked anyway. And the other problem was we hadn't finished the toilet, because we were trying to do everything before by the time Prabhupada got there. We didn't manage to do that. So there was no bathroom on that floor. That meant Prabhupada had to go to the top floor. And Prabhupada was actually sick at the time. So that, therefore, what we had to do was put a bowl in the next room for Prabhupada to use as a urinal. So you can imagine how inconvenient that was to Prabhupada. Now here we're talking about such a powerful, at that time the movement was also becoming very powerful. And here was a great spiritual master, Mahabhagavat. Prabhupada never complained once about anything. I never heard one single complaint. And Prabhupada was very, very, very concerned that all the devotees had been looked after. He was very ecstatic. He gave a wonderful class. We had kirtan. And then he called me up to his room. Now, everything was wrong in the building. Everything was wrong. I mean, you know, if I looked at faults, they were all over the place. And Prabhupada called me in his room. And in a very nice way, Prabhupada asked about the building and about the people across the road. We had a group called the Divine Light across the road. They were right across the road. And Prabhupada had noticed them out of his window, so he asked about them. We used to call him Guru Miraj. He was the Guru Maharaji. So anyway, Prabhupada asked about him for a while, and he asked about the devotees. And at first, actually, when I went in his room, went and sat in Prabhupada's room, and I was completely, I was actually pretty out of it, to be honest. Because before Prabhupada came, I used to drive around in a scooter. I had a scooter. That was the only, because none of us had a car license. And we couldn't afford a car anyway. So I used to drive all over the country in a scooter. So I'd gone down to Newcastle from Edinburgh to deliver an order of incense just to get a bit of money. So I'd gone down there, and I arrived there, and it turned out the shop was closed. That was on the Saturday night. It was Saturday. Friday I arrived there. That's right. I arrived there Friday. It closed. So I had to wait all night Saturday, and Prabhupada was coming that evening. So I had to get back up to, I slept in the sidecar that night, and then I had to drive all the way back up to Edinburgh. Luckily, the devotees there, the Bhagavan was there, but Jayaree went out and hired a big limousine to pick Prabhupada up, which was very nice. We never actually paid for it. Anyway, it was a very nice reception. So Prabhupada also had a very nice reception when he arrived. But I literally came around the corner as Prabhupada was arriving in my little scooter. And I came up, I quickly showered, came down, and then that's when Prabhupada called me to the room. So I was, you know, I imagine driving 200 miles on a scooter. You know? My consciousness. I'm sorry. So I sat down there in front of Prabhupada, sort of completely splayed out. And Prabhupada, this desk was so big, so Prabhupada was leaning on the desk like that, and it was so high. And Prabhupada was in the cushion, so Prabhupada was like that. And then I was the other side of this big desk. And then Prabhupada went like this, and he was showing me how he couldn't reach anything, because the desk was so big. So Prabhupada moved his arm and he said, "My arms are so long." I said, "Oh, Krishna." So I just said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Prabhupada. I felt so bad. So I'm sorry. We don't have any money. I couldn't get anything. This is all I could get you." Prabhupada said, he was actually very happy. He said, "Actually, I'm very pleased." He said, "It's a very nice temple. Krishna has been very kind to you." And then he started talking about Edinburgh, how that was where his teachers were from. So next morning we went on a morning walk, and Prabhupada was telling us a little bit about his when he was at school with these Scottish teachers. They were very principled people, the Scottish missionaries. And Prabhupada liked that. They were also philosophically inclined. So we had some nice talks, and we took Prabhupada around the Edinburgh Castle. And Prabhupada stood up there on the, what do you call those things where they shoot the arrows from? This kind of, Yeah, rampart. So Prabhupada was standing up there looking over Edinburgh. And he looked so serene. When you were with Prabhupada, it was like being with a king, to give an example. But Prabhupada had a majestic aristocracy that is hard to describe. And everything Prabhupada looked at was very intent. He would notice everything very carefully, but you never knew what he was thinking. That was the beauty of Prabhupada. So I was a little bit kind of intrigued what Prabhupada was thinking. So anyway, I was standing next to Srila Prabhupada, and then Prabhupada turned to me and said, "Just see." And I was looking, probably just talking very kind. He said, "Just see." And as I looked down, I could see what Prabhupada, but Prabhupada said, "They're simply attached to their monument." So much attached simply to their monuments. So Prabhupada was, you know, for most people to look over the castle of Edinburgh, to look down on the town, it's actually very picturesque, all these beautiful monuments and this and that. But Prabhupada was disgusted. Just see how attached they are. So that's how you could never predict what Prabhupada was going to say. And then Prabhupada started talking about how the materialist is so much attached to the big concrete, you know, these monuments, and they want to show, they want to create something solid. The basic theme was that Prabhupada said everyone's trying to create something very solid in the material world, even though it's transitory. So anyway, I'll quickly finish up. But basically, we got back to the temple, and Prabhupada, he had to share the shower with us. Actually, what would happen is we'd go to a bath down the road, but every now and again we'd sneak into the shower, thinking that it wasn't Prabhupada's time. So I went in there and had a shower, but Prabhupada, there was a knock on the door, and sure enough, Nanda Kumar said, "Prabhupada, it's Prabhupada." I didn't know what to do. Here I was all soaked up in the shower, and Prabhupada's waiting at the door. So I just literally leapt out, put a towel around, and just ran out of the bathroom. What I didn't know was Prabhupada was standing right outside the door. So it was a very small hallway. So I actually, next minute I was looking at Prabhupada, and he was looking at me, and I was all this dripping soap, suds. So then the next stupid thing was I paid my obeisance. And of course, all the suds went all over Prabhupada's dhoti, on his shoes. And I was sort of lying there, blocking Prabhupada going into the shower room, and covered in soap. And as I got up, I looked again at Prabhupada, and he was simply smiling. He was just thinking, just see this fool. There was no logic in my behavior. But Prabhupada was so kind, so Prabhupada called me in. Now, it was always very rare to kind of get to do intimate things with Prabhupada, but this was very intimate because Prabhupada was going to have a shower. So he only had a gumsho on, and he was shaving. He was starting to shave. So I was actually getting ready, but I was taking my time because I wanted to watch Prabhupada having a shave. So I looked over, so Nanda Kumar brought out the razor and he was handing it to Prabhupada. Now, I didn't know at the time, but Prabhupada was very meticulous about everything, but he was particularly meticulous about his own personal items, how he used things. This particular razor, apparently Nanda Kumar explained that he forgot Prabhupada's razor, so he got another one. And Prabhupada started using the razor, and he looked at it like that. And then he looked at Nanda Kumar and he said, "This is Jalak." Now, first of all, that's right. First of all, he had the razor in his hand like that, and he was pointing, where's the dial? Because if you look in that room, you'll see there's a dial on the razor, which adjusts the cutting. So Prabhupada was saying, "Where's the dial?" But he didn't say it. He just pointed Nanda Kumar. Nanda Kumar could understand. So he said, "No." He said, "Prabhupada, that's not Gillette." So first of all, Prabhupada said, "This is Gillette." Then he pointed to the dial. And then Nanda Kumar said, "No, Prabhupada, this is not Gillette." And Prabhupada went, "Simply bogus." And it was so wonderful because all of this was very intense. It was like everything Prabhupada did had some sort of majestic intensity. There was lessons galore to be learned. But basically, it looked like it was almost like Prabhupada was in class dismissing the entire Mayavadi philosophy. He just dismissed this razor, and he just, there was a shelf there, and he just gently sort of flung it on that shelf. But he just said, "Simply bogus." And I was fascinated. And anyway, we had to run off and get Prabhupada a dial razor right away. So I rushed off to do that. But again, I'm going to quickly finish this. I could talk all night, but it's one of those things. But anyway, basically, we took Prabhupada to a program. And Prabhupada liked trains, because in England the trains were good, and also it was very comfortable. So anyway, Prabhupada went by train. We had a big festival that night. We put out advertisements and had a picture of the globe, the planet, and had Prabhupada's face in the middle of the planet. And it was not just face, but Prabhupada's body. But it said, "World leader, Hare Krishna movement comes to Glasgow." And we plastered the town. So the hall was packed. And Prabhupada gave a very wonderful lecture. It was very wonderful. I could tell a whole story about that. And we had a big rousing kirtan. But what we forgot was we had no prasadam for Prabhupada. Now, because I was organizing the whole program and we had no money, I actually had to collect the money when people were coming in to go and book Prabhupada's room at the airport because he was leaving that night. So as people were coming in, I was going up to them saying, "Could you help out because our guru has come, but we have no money to get him a room. And he's leaving tonight, we need to get him a hotel room." So I collected the money. Now I had to do all this while I was actually setting up the program and everything else. And then I had to go to the airport and book the room, pay for it and everything. And then come back and do the program. So there was a lot of senior devotees there, so the program went on. But anyway, at the end of the program, we had no prasadam. And some devotee came to me and said, "Where's Prabhupada's prasadam?" And I was flabbergasted. I realized I didn't have any prasadam and no one else had brought prasadam. So that means Prabhupada hadn't eaten the whole day. And I don't know what he had for breakfast. He used to eat a very light breakfast. So what I did was cut up all these oranges. Our feast. We had a feast for the festival. It was oranges. And I brought Prabhupada must have asked for some of the feast, which was oranges. So we brought Prabhupada lots of oranges. I think it was about 15 oranges. So So he chopped them all up and he brought them into Prabhupada, and Prabhupada sat there very elegantly eating these oranges. Again, he never complained. He just ate the oranges. And so then what happened was that it was time for Prabhupada to go, and I had to take him to the hotel. So with his servant and one other servant, we were leaving. All the other devotees were, it was like this was a special room behind where the artists get changed or something. So it was just really Prabhupada, his servant, and me. So I went out and I opened the door for Prabhupada. And as you open the door, you step down a little bit. So as Prabhupada came out, then I remember, till this day, I'll never forget that, but as Prabhupada was coming down the hallway, Prabhupada looked completely intoxicated with love of God. It was like that. It describes a little bit how Lord Nityananda has a certain gait when he walks. So Prabhupada had this certain gait. It was very ecstatic anyway. And I could see that Prabhupada was actually in a very transcendental ecstasy. And then when he reached the door, Prabhupada looked over at me, and we were very close, because as I opened the door, Prabhupada came out. So then he just took both his hands and put them on my head, and he started rubbing my head. And I was just bewildered. I didn't know what was going on. And at this time, of course, Prabhupada was about maybe the same height as me. So we were both sort of face to face. And then Prabhupada said, "I am very, very pleased with what you have done." He says, "So now carry on this all over." And I'm not sure if Prabhupada said all over UK, but he said all over. And then Prabhupada just gave a very beautiful smile, and then he went down the steps. And then we got in this beaten old Sankirtan van, because the limousine had gone and we had no money. So we had an old beaten up Sankirtan van, which was also used for vegetable collection and everything else. So Prabhupada got in the front and I was driving. So Prabhupada was sitting there in the front, there was me and a bunch of devotees behind, all sticking their head over waiting for Prabhupada what he was going to say. So Prabhupada just talked about the program, how he enjoyed it. And then there was these really scruffy kids, I mean really dirty street kids. They came to the program and they were dancing like anything at the end kirtan. And Prabhupada seemed to be giving them incredible attention. You could tell he was encouraging them and really like that. So Prabhupada was talking about the program. Then Dhananjaya said, "Yeah, but those kids, Prabhupada, they were kind of creating a disturbance." For Dhananjaya, anyway. So he mentioned the problem. They were a bit of a nuisance, I think he said, or something like that. But I said, "No, they are devotees. Somehow they had a relationship with Prabhupada." That's what I felt from it. They were devotees. And this was their contact with Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was he was quite strong about it. He said, "No, no, they are devotees." And then Dhananjaya, "Yeah, but they were very dirty, Prabhupada. That is their parents." So it's like Dhananjaya was criticizing a devotee and Prabhupada was chastising him. And so anyway, cut a long story short, we got to the airport, the hotel, airport hotel, and then we went into the sort of reception where you check in. So you never usually sit with your Guru Maharaj. You always sit on the floor. But I had to talk to Prabhupada, so I sat right next to Prabhupada. So I said, "Srila Prabhupada," because at this time I was feeling terrible that Prabhupada hadn't eaten. So I said, "Can I get you anything to eat?" He said, "Oh, you can get." So then I thought to myself, yeah. You know, in my mind I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to get something, even if I have to go down that kitchen, cook it myself, or whatever. So I said, "Yeah, I can get you, Prabhupada." He said, "Oh, what can you get?" So I said, "Oh, I'm going to get you vegetables. Would you like, Prabhupada, vegetables?" I said, "Yes, that would be nice. And rice and vegetables." So I was saying these different things, and Prabhupada was going, "Yes, yes, yes." So I went off, and then I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to take on this hotel. They're going to cook, let me cook for Prabhupada. I'm going to get him some prasadam. So my GBC was Shyam Sundar at that time, and also a very close friend. So I went up to Shyam and I said, "Prabhupada's hungry and we've got to get him prasadam." Shyam said, "What are you going to get Prabhupada?" I said, "I'm going to cook him some vegetables. I just talked to Prabhupada. He wants vegetables, he wants rice, and we're going to do it." He said, "You can't do that in a hotel. They're not going to let you go in the kitchen." I said, oh, they will, they will. I'll ask them. No, no, no. He said, well, use room service. So anyway, yeah, my cooking went out the window. So I took Prabhupada up to the room, and we ordered room service. Oh, no, that was right. While I was sitting with Prabhupada, at first, that's right, I forgot that. I said to Prabhupada, what would you like? And then Prabhupada, obviously, I hadn't been to hotels many times, knew there wasn't a great selection. You're limited. You can only get a limited amount of a thing, isn't it? No matter what you try to get in your hand, how much can you hold? Isn't it? Try and hold more than you can hold, and it falls off your hand. In your eyes, how much can you grasp? You can never see more than actually one part of what you're seeing, just like I'm sitting in this room. 50% of it is cut off. So how can I talk about what's behind me? And even I can't talk about what's behind me, and I'm sitting in the exact place. So therefore, when there's limited, then there's adjustment. Because you have to make adjustment. I have to move my head. Oh, I saw someone. I didn't see him. Now I see him. You see? So I have to make adjustment. So, in that sense, because we're in the limited world and everything is limited, we sometimes think that Guru is also limited. You see, this is our nature, that there may be some limited aspect to Guru. There is no limited aspect. Just like I was in a room with Srila Prabhupada, and we were discussing this topic. So, one newspaper reporter had come with some other newspaper reporters, and they were big, big newspapers. There was the Times, the Daily Mirror, there was the Telegraph, there was a few, there was about 20 reporters in the room in Burry Place. So Prabhupada, it was very ecstatic to watch Prabhupada when he dealt with people. Prabhupada had an amazing psychology. It was, you can't even describe it, because he never ever was victimized by anyone. In the material world, everyone is victimized. Actually, we're all victims. Because a victim means someone who may be overcome by more powerful thing, isn't it? That's what a victim is in a sort of general term. So I always used to think with reporters, of course, you had to behave in a certain way and everything else. But Prabhupada was hilarious because he was so direct, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing. And yet, the people who he was direct with were actually always very respectful because they knew that he was speaking the truth. He never tried to make any kind of, adjustment to the situation to be more acceptable or non-acceptable. Just like in Amsterdam when Prabhupada was doing the installation of Jagannath deities, then there was all these cameras there. There was about 2 television stations. And there was all sorts of reporters. But anyway, the devotees had made a complete mess up of the installation, including the fact that they had no items for the fire sacrifice. Now, Prabhupada actually was disturbed. He was visually disturbed at this negligence. Oh, no. Huh? Really? I didn't know. Well, I always take the shower with that.